Only the victim is alive and the murderers are not. It's a pity you didn't know when you started your game of murder that I was playing too.
It has been established that the persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Believe in ghosts?
First simply disappears, the other two died.
Pretties. It's your criminal researcher and host, Ashley Lana, welcoming you to the show, where together, my fear cult, we dissect the complex historical events and crimes from around the world. Join me as we examine the depths of human nature and unravel the mysteries of our past. Get ready for a captivating journey through history's darkest moments, and in this case, the paranormal. So with that being said, welcome to Lullaby. In our previous episode, we embarked on a chilling journey into the lives of Canada's notorious Ken and Barbie killers, Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka. And your overwhelming support for the longer episode format was truly appreciated, and I extend my heartfelt gratitude. This week, we venture into the realm of the paranormal. Brace yourselves as we delve into the mysterious surrounding of the most haunted house in America. Prepare for an eerie exploration of the supernatural as we uncover the secrets that lie within its haunted walls. This episode is spine-tingling, and it will leave you questioning the boundaries between the living and the dead. So stay tuned for an unforgettable encounter with the unknown. My sources for this episode include The Night the DeFeos Died, Reinvestigating the Amityville Murders by Rick Osuna, The Real Amityville Horror, The True Story Behind the Brutal DeFeo Murders by Francis J. Armstrong, The Lutz versus Weber Trial, The Real Amityville Horror 2005 documentary, The Amityville Horror by Jay Anson, although it's clearly not for factual reference, obviously. But I had to read it just to see what was I got went on. So get comfortable, because sweet dreams are made of these. The following story contains subject matter involving graphic descriptions of crimes against children, mental illness, religion, the paranormal, and murder. Please take into consideration that some topics may be disturbing for some listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised. This is the true story of the real Amityville Horror. Born on September 26, 1951, in Brooklyn, New York, Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr. was the eldest of five children in the DeFeo family. His parents, Ronald DeFeo Sr. and Louise Marie Briganti, lived in a small apartment in Brooklyn. As their family grew, they needed more space. So in 1965, Louise's father purchased a charming Dutch colonial-style house called the Amityville House at 112 Ocean Avenue, located just an hour outside of New York City. The house was built in 1924 by John and Catherine Moynihan, and it boasted 4,000 square feet of living space that included five bedrooms, three and a half bathrooms, a basement, a small boathouse, a dock, and a backyard pool. After the passing of the Moynihans, their descendants sold the house to the DeFeo family. To the community, the DeFeos appeared to live a life of wealth, with many assuming that Ronald Sr.'s job as a car salesman afforded them their luxurious lifestyle. However, it was Louise's father who had given the family an estimated $50,000. Visitors to their home would be greeted with large family portraits adorning the walls, creating the illusion of a warm and close-knit family. But, As is often the case with true crime stories, appearances can be very deceiving. Butch's father, Ronald Sr., was a harsh and aggressive man who had no qualms about verbally and physically abusing his children, particularly his eldest son, Ronald Jr., who was affectionately known as Butch. To avoid confusion, I will refer to Ronald Jr. as Butch throughout the rest of the story. Butch's uncle, Michael, recalled the disturbing incident that occurred in 1953, when Butch was only 2 years old. The family was gathering in the basement watching television when Ronald Sr. suddenly and forcefully pushed Butch into the wall, causing him to hit his head and shoulder. The incident happened so quickly, it left the room filled with a heavy silence. Ronald Sr.'s explosive temper led to a pattern of regular abuse towards Louise, Butch's mother, and the rest of the children. On one occasion, while Louise was carrying a laundry basket up the stairs from the basement, Ronald Sr. viciously punched her in the face, causing her to tumble down the stairs. The abusive dynamic within the DeFeo household was so severe that even the children's friends were afraid to enter the house, fearing Ronald Sr.'s anger towards his own family. During his childhood, Butch was plagued by a brooding demeanor and struggled with his weight, making him an easy target for cruel jokes and relentless bullying at school. The other kids would mockingly refer to him as Porkchop and the Blob and even Bucky Beaver. As he grew older, Butch found it increasingly difficult to connect with his father. Ronald Sr. would criticize Butch for not standing up to his bullies, yet he would physically abuse him when he dared speak up against his own father's mistreatment. This dysfunctional father-son relationship took a toll on Butch, leading him to develop a fiery temper that surpassed even that of his father. He began to lash out against Ronald Sr. and harbored deep resentment towards his mother for her apparent indifference to the abuse. At the age of 13, Butch's anger escalated to the point where he had physically attacked his own grandfather. Concerned for his well-being, the family sought help from a psychiatrist, but Butch remained unresponsive during the sessions. It became increasingly evident that Butch's dark side was only growing stronger. Now, in his teens, little Butchy Butch, he was very unpredictable, and he was diagnosed with our favorite term here at the Fear Cult, antisocial personality disorder. And sociopathy. So he displayed the key signs such as aggressive anger, irresponsibility, the lack of concern or remorse for anyone else, and a disregard for normal social behaviors. So here are some examples from his teens. On more than one occasion, he took a 12-gauge shotgun and pointed the barrel at his father, threatening to kill him, to the extent of even pulling the trigger once, but luckily the gun jammed. And Butch would also point the shotgun at his friends just to terrorize him for his own enjoyment. And one time a friend even left, and the next day Butch was like, "Oh, where did you go? We were having such a good time." And the guy just stared and said, "You had a gun between my eyes." And then Butch just slowly smiled and walked away. He enjoyed the fear that he gave his friend. Now, a shotgun, now that's scary as hell. Like, those things take down elephants. Like, as a Canadian, I don't know much about firearms, but I do know that a shotgun will fucking end your life. So, like, when I grew up, I was a farm kid, and yes, like, my grandparents had a gun license, so there, it was most likely for, like, if a coyote would get in the backyard, and then it would terrorize the sheep. Ba-bang! But it wouldn't be to kill them, it'd mostly just be to scare them off. Kids, we couldn't touch these guns. God, Lord knows we couldn't fucking touch them. So what we would do was we would actually go, this is so bad, we would grab willow branches. And for those of you who don't know, willow branches are very long and whippy. And if you grabbed one of those bastards and got the angle just right on your friend's like calf muscle or the hamstring, mercy me. That is what we did. Those little bastards packed a wallop. So the thought of a shotgun or any firearm is just absolutely terrifying to me. So if a gun came out, like, yes, of course that would ruin the entire mood, Butch. That's not even a good time. So to show that at like 13 years old, he started doing this is red flag hoiven high. Now, at the age of 17, Butch found himself entangled in a destructive grip with alcohol and heavy drugs, to put it lightly. And his addiction, it spanned across substances like heroin, LSD, and speed. And in an attempt to address this troubling behavior, his parents resorted to, well, a rather un- conventional approach, they tried to bribe him into quitting by showering him with lavish gifts like a speedboat that was like 14 grand, while most parents would opt for interventions or intensive therapy. But Butch's parents, they simply just indulged his desires. Consequently, his classmates labeled him as violent and an entitled individual, leading him to eventually drop out of Amityville High School. So when Butch turned 18, his father managed to secure him a job at his grandfather's Buick dealership, and he was assigned to the service department, so he did oil changes and tune-ups. And he was a terrible employee. It reminds me of Colin Farrell's character in Horrible Bosses, if you've ever seen that movie. Colin Farrell plays this son whose father owns, I'm not even sure what the company is, I don't remember, but he takes everything for granted because he's pretty much just an heir to this company, and he's a goddamn mess. Butch, this is the equivalent. And what was really perplexing about the situation was to just witness how his father would easily resort to violence whenever Butch displayed a bad attitude, yet simultaneously he enabled his reckless behavior by allowing him to get away with everything. Now, despite being an unreliable worker, Butch's father continued to provide him with stipends even when he failed to show up to work, so he was still getting paid. Unfortunately, all the money that was handed to him by his parents only fueled his drug addiction further, and then the cycle continued. And Butch displayed a complete lack of concern for the consequences of his actions, and he even boasted to his psychiatrist about exploiting the privileges of working for his family business. One incident that just exemplifies Butch's disregard for others is he was entrusted to deposit 19 grand in money and checks at the bank on behalf of his grandfather's dealership. But instead, what old Butch decided to do was, rather than fulfilling this responsibility, he selfishly pocketed the money and orchestrated a fake robbery. And then when he was questioned by the police, Butch's temper just flared, and it caused him to inadvertently expose his plan. And then when his father confronted him, questioning him why he would steal from his own family, he was only met with Butch threatening to kill him. Now, these behaviors exhibited by Butch are indicative of antisocial personality disorder, which he was diagnosed with, and they merely just scratch the surface of his troubled psyche. And I will go deeper into his psychiatric diagnosis upon the trial. So let's continue. Butch started a relationship with a young woman named Sherry Klein. Over time, their relationship took a dark turn as his explosive temper and violent outbursts became more frequent. Sherry vividly remembers the times when Butch and his friends would gather at her apartment. They would enjoy each other's company with drinks and food. However, whenever Butch became intoxicated, his anger would ignite, leading to terrifying incidences. There was one occasion that crossed all boundaries. Butch's aggression escalated to the point where he threw Sherry across the room. Relentlessly, he pursued her. In a desperate attempt to escape, Sherry had no choice but to crawl through the window, fearing for her life. As time went on, Butch's explosive temper became notorious within the community. He would seize the opportunity to display his bravado and physical strength, often resorting to intimidation and violence. One incident involved a neighborhood mother named Mrs. Nemeth. Butch falsely accused her child of desecrating a religious shrine of Jesus Christ that stood in front of the DeFeo home. When Mrs. Nemeth defended her daughter, denying any involvement in such a blasphemous act, Butch's anger reached new heights. He threatened Mrs. Nemeth, shouting that if she were not a woman, he would have violently beaten her to the ground. Filled with fear, Mrs. Nemeth attempted to walk away, but when Butch persisted, he continued to intimidate and threaten her, throwing his fists in the air, claiming to punch her in the face. In 1973, Ronald Sr. and his wife Louise found themselves in a desperate situation with their son Butch. His drug addiction had tightened its grip, and with the constant death threats, everything had become unbearable. Seeking help once again, they made the difficult decision to take Butch to see a psychiatrist. After speaking with Butch, the psychiatrist shared a grave warning to the concerned parents that if they didn't commit him to a professional institution, their lives were in immediate danger. However, instead of heeding the psychiatrist's advice, Butch expressed his desire to move out. Despite the severity of the situation, Ronald Sr. insisted that Butch stay and attempt to appease him by offering him more money as a bribe. The family's refusal to address the underlying issues and seek proper help only deepened the dangerous path Butch was already on. On November 12, 1974, Butch DeFeo decided to take the day off from work due to an upset stomach. He stayed home, lounging on the sofa, and took some acid while watching a movie on television. As the sun began to set, Butch drifted into a slumber, still feeling the effects of the acid. At 3:15 a.m. on November 13, 1974, Butch DeFeo woke up in the basement rec room feeling groggy. He stood up and, still under the influence, made his way through the dark Amityville house, holding a .35-caliber Marlin rifle. The door creaked open as he entered the parents' bedroom, revealing the silhouette of their 23-year-old son standing at the foot of the bed. In a horrifying act, Butch fired two shots, killing his 43-year-old father, Ronald DeFeo Sr. The first bullet struck Ronald's lower back, shattering his kidney, while the second entered the base of his spine and lodged in his neck. The deputy chief medical examiner's testimony revealed that the trajectories of the bullets were different, indicating that Ronald Sr. had initially gotten up off the bed and was then repositioned back on it, lying on his stomach. After shooting his father, Butch turned his attention to his mother, who heard the gunshots and started screaming for her husband. In an interview, Butch claimed that he felt anger towards his mother for crying to the man who abused her and her children for years. Louise, Butch's mother, allegedly reached for a gun, and Butch shot her twice. One bullet struck her chest, while the other hit her upper right abdomen, causing severe damage to her rib cage, liver, lungs, and diaphragm. The bodies of Ronald Sr. and Louise were left lying face down on their stomachs. Coroners concluded that the parents may have remained alive for up to 10 minutes after being shot. Butch's rampage didn't stop there. He continued down the hallway, entering the bedroom where his 11-year-old brother Mark and 9-year-old brother John slept. Their beds were positioned parallel to each other. Standing just a few feet away, Butch callously fired bullets into their backs, and with the bullets exiting through the mattress below, the boys were left lying on their stomachs, mirroring the position of their parents. It was revealed that Mark had suffered a football injury that left him unable to move without a wheelchair. He relied on someone to turn him over in the bed and likely had to sleep on his back. When the police discovered their bodies, both John and Mark were found on their stomachs, their heads buried into their pillows, meaning that Butch had to turn his brothers over. Butch later recalled that as he stood in the darkness, he watched the foot of his brothers twitch, a chilling testament to the horror he had unleashed. Butch's next target was his 13-year-old sister, Allison. She awoke to the sight of a rifle pointed to the side of her head. Without hesitation, her eldest brother fired a fatal shot, obliterating her brain as the bullet passed through her opposite ear. The bullet tore through the bedding and ricocheted off the wall at the head of the bed, and it fell to the floor. Allison died instantly, and the spent cartridges were ejected into a pool of her own blood. After the brutal murder of his sister Allison, Butch proceeded to the attic room where his 18-year-old sister Dawn slept. She was awake at the time and attempted to put up a fight. She began wrestling the gun away from Butch. However, he overpowered her and threw her body onto the bed. With cold determination, Butch fired a bullet into her cervical spine, causing extensive damage to her brain. The mattress became saturated with brain matter and blood, leaving a gruesome scene. With Dawn's death, a total of 6 lives were taken, earning the case the infamous name of the Amityville Murder House. Butch, now covered in the blood of his family, retraced his steps through the house, collecting the bullet casings left behind in each room. He disposed of the .35 Marlin, making sure to leave no trace of the weapon. He then made his way to the backyard, where he hid his blood-soaked clothes in a drainage pipe. After quickly showering, Butch went to work as if nothing had happened. When his co-workers inquired about the absence of his father, Ronald Sr., Butch pleaded ignorance, claiming he had no idea why his family wasn't answering the phone. He even called the family home himself, pretending to be concerned. Butch decided to leave work early, telling everyone he encountered that he couldn't reach his family. Later on Wednesday, November 13th, around 6:39 p.m., Butch burst into Henry's bar, located just a few blocks away from the DeFeo home. Frantically, he shouted for help, claiming that his parents had been shot, saying, quote, "You've got to help me. I think my mother and father are shot." A group of 6 men, including Joe Yeswit, followed Butch back to his house and immediately called the police. The bodies were left in the house for 48 hours before being removed. Journalist Joel Martin was one of the first journalists to arrive at the scene, and he witnessed the officers carrying several bodies out of the DeFeo home. In one horrific moment, one of the murdered children fell out of the tarp as they were being carried, shocking the curious crowd of neighbors who had gathered. Many of them commented that if it was only Butch who was left alive, it wouldn't be surprising if he was guilty. Amityville bar owner Al Ubert described Butch DeFeo as follows. "He was a punk. All he did was drink, gamble, and fight. If you knew him and knew the situation, I guess you ever spend any time around him, it was not something that he was incapable of doing. And when everyone else is dead, and he's not, you know. Butch was immediately taken into protective custody and questioned by the police. Initially, he claimed that a mafia hitman named Luis Fellini was responsible for the DeFeo murders, due to an old vendetta. Butch explained that he and Fellini had a previous altercation when Butch painted his car at the dealership and Fellini was dissatisfied with the quality. Butch threw an object at Fellini, who ducked and accidentally broke the window of the car behind him. Butch told his father about the incident, and according to Butch, this led to a war between his family and the Fellinis. Butch embellished the story further, claiming that Fellini had called his father and ordered a hit on the DeFeo family. However, when detectives questioned Luis Fellini, he provided a strong alibi, proving that he was not in New York at the time of the DeFeo murders. Meanwhile, the forensics team discovered the .35 Marlin rifle, along with evidence that Butch had attempted to purchase a silencer weeks before the murders. As the investigation continued, Butch admitted to using heroin and other drugs while on parole. He also revealed that his sister Dawn had previously provided him with urine for his drug tests. Butch went into detail about other petty crimes he had committed, seemingly in an attempt to appear honest and divert suspicion away from himself. After 12 hours of interrogation, Butch finally confessed to the murder of his family. He pleaded insanity, claiming that he had killed them out of self-defense because they were plotting to kill him. He exclaimed, quote, "Once I started, I just couldn't stop. It went so fast." Following his confession, Butch's true feelings towards his family began to surface. He held nothing back as he expressed his hatred for his father, calling his mother Louise a terrible cook who made awful dinners. And he described his younger brothers as messy, and referred to his 18-year-old sister Dawn as a fat fuck and annoying for playing her music too loud. Butch even smirked as he insulted his grandfather, calling him a cheap bastard and admitting to taking advantage of him by stealing from him whenever he could. On October 14, 1975, Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr. found himself in the midst of a trial, facing 6 counts of second-degree murder. Throughout the proceedings, Butch's lawyer, William Weber, sought to establish an insanity plea. Weber argued that Butch was tormented by voices in his head, compelling him to commit the heinous acts to murdering his own family. According to Butch, a sinister hooded demon with long black hands had provided him with the shotgun used to kill the family. The courtroom was left in shock when Butch revealed that his belief was the devil himself had personally manipulated him. The release of the horror film The Exorcist a year prior had sparked waves of satanic panic. Claims of possession had surged, and it seemed that every crime was attributed to the influence of the devil, as defendants sought the insanity plea. Butch maintained that the devil had orchestrated a scenario where the entire family slept soundly throughout the night, while the gunshots were cleverly muffled by his powers, preventing the neighborhood from hearing the horrifying events unfold. Despite his attorney's best efforts to build a case around the insanity plea, their endeavors ultimately proved unsuccessful. Defense psychiatrist Daniel Schwartz conducted a thorough evaluation of Butch and diagnosed him as a delusional, neurotic psychopath with a dissociative disorder. However, state psychiatrist Dr. Harold Zolon passionately opposed the insanity plea, dismissing all of Butch's stories as mere fabrications aimed at claiming innocence. Dr. Zolon argued that Butch did not exhibit any signs of a dissociative disorder, contradicting the defense's testimony. In fact, he believed that Butch's stories indicated a clear element of premeditation, suggesting that the crimes were not committed in a state of insanity, saying, quote, "Although DeFeo was a user of heroin and LSD, he had an antisocial personality disorder and was aware of his actions at the time of the crime." So despite Butch's attempts to shift the blame towards the devil and make excuses for his actions, psychiatrists, they confirmed that he exhibited antisocial personality disorder, lack of empathy, narcissism, manipulative behavior, deceitfulness, and emotional instability. It was all clear that Butch knew right from wrong, but he chose to disregard it and proceed to brutally murder 6 members of his own family. The evidence found at the crime scene supported the premeditated nature of the murders. Gunshot residue on each of the body's victims. Now, this indicated that the gun had been fired at close range, and the fact that the bodies were found in separate bedrooms suggests that there was time between each murder for Butch to contemplate his actions. Furthermore, Butch took the initiative to pick up the gunshot shell casings. Sometimes stuff is hard to say. So he disposed of the evidence, and this showed a level of awareness and consciousness of his actions. So after he disposed of the bloody clothes in the drainpipe in the backyard, Butch showered, he cleaned up, and then he headed to work as if nothing had happened. This just further demonstrates his coherence and lack of remorse for the heinous crimes that he committed. And on November 21st, 1975, Butch DeFeo was sentenced to 6 concurrent sentences of 25 years to life in prison for his crimes. However, there's always a however, after his conviction, Butch continued to make desperate attempts to shift the blame. He tried to blame the devil and claimed that he was under the influence of large amounts of alcohol mixed with drugs, and he even went as far as to accuse his sister Dawn of being the one responsible for killing the family, and that he claimed he only acted out of self-defense when he killed her. So these attempts, he's attempting to deflect responsibility, only this only just further highlights Butch's manipulative and deceitful nature. So this is where it gets interesting. Criminologist Herman Race, he was hired by the defense team and testified that he believed that more than one rifle was used to murder the DeFeos, implementing that another person was involved. Dun, dun, dun. So Butch starts changing his story about what happened the night of the Amityville murders. So take note that Butch's history is of lying and manipulation. So take his stories with caution. We're going to time travel here from 1975 to 2000, when Butch claims to really get his story straight. All right. Butch does this interview with author Rick Osana, who's the author of The Night the DeFeos Died. And he claims that his 18-year-old sister Dawn was behind the plot of the murders, but his grandfather didn't want him to shame the family, so he was told to keep his mouth shut and to take the blame for the murders. Butch's claim was actually defended by a pre-existing affidavit signed by Dawn's boyfriend, William Davidich, on July 24, 1990, painting the idea that Dawn DeFeo was a rebellious teenager in love who spiraled out of control, and I have the affidavit, and I'm going to read it. Here we go. Sworn affidavit by William Davidich, State of Florida, County... Ooh, Florida! What's up, Florida? Florida, my people! I am 33 years of age, and I reside at... It's blanked out. Of course it's blanked out. That I was the boyfriend of Dawn DeFeo, and that I am a friend of Ronald DeFeo Jr., and I was friends with the rest of the DeFeo family. That I have direct knowledge about Dawn DeFeo as she was in love with me and wanted to come to Florida to live with me. Aww. But her mother, Louise DeFeo, and her father, Ronald DeFeo Sr., forbade her from doing so, which led to the hostile incidences between Dawn and her mother and father over all of this. And Dawn was determined to come to Florida, no matter what. I have direct knowledge that Dawn DeFeo was using drugs, LSD, and... mescaline? Oh, Jesus, girl, chill out, from time to time, and about Dawn's bad temper when it got out of hand on occasions. I have direct knowledge of Dawn's hatred towards her mother and father, and how Dawn's only use for Butch, Ronald DeFeo Jr., was to use him, as Butch, Ronald Jr., gave Dawn money that requested from him, even gave me, William Davidich, money to take Dawn to her high school prom, but Dawn's only use for Butch, Ronald Jr., was to use him. Okay, well, you could have been a lot more specific there, William Davidich. I have direct knowledge of Dawn's attitude right up to the beginning of November 1974 as per phone conversations with her from Florida to Amityville. Wherefore, the above is true and correct to the best of this person's knowledge. William Davidich. Sworn to before me, July 24th. I can only assume it's 1990 because it's blacked out. Oh, yeah, 1990. There we go. This photocopy of this affidavit is just a god nightmare to read. I apologize for the inconsistencies. A lot of it's blacked out because of privacy matters. The official report states that Dawn DeFeo did have, quote, partially burnt powder particles on her body, which could indicate that she may have fired a gun the night of the DeFeo murders. It could also indicate that while she was wrestling with Butch in his story, that some landed on her. This could potentially back up Butch's claims, even though you have to remember Butch is a liar. He is known for lying. So take this with a grain of salt. But Butch DeFeo's final story was that his sister approached him wanting to murder their family and gave him the gun. His mother, Louise, and his siblings, they were not part of the primary plan. Butch said that he entered their parents' bedroom with the intent to scare the father with the .35 Marlin until Ronald Sr. stood up, and then this scared Butch, and he fired the gun. During this time, he heard his mother scream for their father, which pissed off Butch because he couldn't understand why someone who was being abused by this man would cry for him. Butch, not everyone's a fucking sociopath or psychopath. So in this time, while this was proceeding, Butch heard two shots fire and claims it was Dawn shooting their mother when Louise drew a gun. So at this point, Butch killed the father, which was part of the plan. Dawn killed the mother, which was not part of the plan. And then apparently Dawn didn't want witnesses, so she killed the rest of her siblings. And this pissed off Butch, and he confronted her, and then he shot her in self-defense. So according to Butch's story, he killed the father and he killed Dawn out of self-defense, and Dawn killed everyone else. Whew. But then Butch just keeps... his story changes so much. It's like the wind. And he says in 1994, after he admits to being the one that killed everyone, he says, quote, "I can say I knew something bad was going to happen. Things were going to happen to my mother and father. I told the police things that were true only to get the pressure off of me," end quote. Now, in that same interview, Butch explained that he didn't know what happened, saying, quote, "I don't know what happened. I'm looking at my mother and my father dead. My sister's gone. I got scared." Experts say that if Butch's sister Dawn did help him with the murders, then it would explain why criminologist Herman Ray suggested that two high-powered rifles were involved in the crime. Now stay with me here, because I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all, but I'm, for the sake of this case, I'm going to jump down this rabbit hole, all right? Fear cult, stay with me here. Butch changes up his story, right? And then he claims that he saw a demon. Well, using this evidence of possible two firearms and his sister being involved, let's see if we could try to make sense of this, okay? Butch woke up at 3:15 a.m. and says that a demon with black hands gave him the rifle. Now, if Butch was whacked out on acid, as he was previously, and like a fifth of scotch, as he's maybe waking up and all dopey, he possibly could have seen his sister as a demon. And then in that time frame, see, now this is where the dissociative state would come into play, is he didn't remember actually killing his... No, I'm sorry. He admitted way too many times what happened. I'm not even gonna humor this. I can't go against the facts. I'm sorry. I gotta move on. Years later, journalist Rick Moran, he covered the murders, and he got a call from a drug enforcement agent who explained that he had the DeFeo home under surveillance at the time of the murders. And he said that he seen Dawn leave the house wearing a hood and carrying a rifle, and that she headed towards the dock to dispose of the gun, which is where the gun had been located later by police dogs. There's so many questions I have about this. Like, one of them being, if the house was under surveillance, how did this operative not hear 8 gunshots fired that night? Or why did he wait years to come forward with this information? These little things are what, like, timeline-wise, are really important to trying to understand a crime. So Butch shifts the blame again by stating that he was possessed by the devil. He bounces back and forth between this one. So when Butch was interviewed in prison, he explained that a priest who was in the courtroom during his trial said, quote, "Watching my performance on the witness stand, he felt that my performance, I had been possessed by the devil," end quote. Now, while watching this 1994 interview, you can see Butch light up with amusement when he retells the priest watching his performance. And it's because of that which makes me believe that he is full of crap. You don't use the word performance when describing that you were possessed. I was acting dead. That was the story of Butch DeFeo. That was the story that he told, and he told it until the day he died in prison on March 12th, 2011, at 69 years old. And he left behind an unnamed daughter who was born prior to the murders. So I just made it easier on everyone by explaining the entire DeFeo murder and the trial, which obviously time jumps a bit. And it's very difficult to explain really complex stories with multiple people involved when they're so complex to retell. So I try my best to give you clarity. Fear Cult, I love you. God bless you. So let's time travel back to 1975. And now the most common story of the Amityville Horror is about to begin, detailed by the accounts of the Lutz family. On December 18, 1975, only 13 months after the murders, the Lutz family purchased the Amityville murder house for $80,000. The large home was still furnished with the items that the DeFeos owned at the time of the murder, but this didn't stop the new family from considering the deal a dream come true. The Lutz family consisted of George, Kathy, and Kathy's three children. Together, they moved into the Amityville house on July 4, 1974. To address their concerns, George contacted Reverend Ralph Pecoraro, a priest, to bless their house on the day they moved in. According to the Lutz family, Reverend Pecoraro experienced an uneasy presence in the house while he performed the blessing. He splashed holy water around while reciting prayers, attempting to cleanse the home of any negative energy or spirits. This was one of the initial steps taken by the Lutz family to address any possible hauntings or supernatural occurrences that could take place in the house. When Reverend Pecoraro entered the sewing room, which was Don DeFeo's previous bedroom, the temperature felt cold, and a deep voice growled at the priest, telling him to get out. In a 1979 interview with the television show In Search Of, Reverend Pecoraro revealed the events of that day he blessed the home, saying, quote, "I felt a rather deep voice behind me saying, 'Get out.' It seemed so directed towards me that I felt really quite startled. I felt a slap across the face at one point. I felt somebody slap me, and there was no one there." Pecoraro told the Lutzes that the voice had told him not to use the sewing room in the bedroom and not to let anyone sleep in there. Within an hour of unpacking, the Lutz's dog, who was on a leash in the backyard, became squirrely and jumped over the fence trying to hang itself. Luckily, George was able to save the animal just in time. Soon after the priest left the home, he developed a high fever and stigmata blisters festering from the palms of his hands. Stigmata is the marks corresponding to those left on the body of Jesus Christ by the crucifixion. Doctors could not explain the wounds, but Reverend Pecoraro had to warn the Lutz family. He picked up the telephone and dialed the Amityville home. When George picked up, only noise and interference was heard, preventing the priest from warning the family. And within days, the Lutz family noticed the evil presence lurking within the Amityville house. Starting from that first night in the murder house, the Lutzes experienced personality changes. The three children had developed such an attitude that the parents began beating the children with a strap and large wooden spoons. George became irritable and aggressive, taking his frustration out on Kathy and the three children. He became increasingly more violent. His body was constantly freezing, which caused George to chop wood in the backyard for hours to feed the roaring fire that lived in the home. As weeks progressed, strange odors crept into the home, ranging from the smell of cheap ladies' perfume to bile and vomit. Strange green slime started to seep from the walls and the windowsills, and Kathy struggled to remove the stubborn black stains that had miraculously appeared in the toilets, defying the power of bleach. George Lutz claimed in the documentary titled The Real Amityville Horror that even the fine china in the house had turned black with evil. Meanwhile, an unsettling phenomenon unfolded in the attic, where flies began to multiply at an alarming rate, much to the bewilderment of the Lutz family, considering it was the heart of winter. Kathy had fastened a 12-inch crucifix that hung on the wall. One night, it swung upside down, and it was after that that Kathy started getting physically touched by the presence in the house. George would get angry when the family presented their fears, insisting that they should leave or get some help. George began waking up every night at 3:15 a.m., the precise time of the DeFeo family murders. He would pace the hallways, hearing strange grunts and growls from the walls. The haunting intensified as doors and cabinets were violently flung open, tearing the doors from the hinges by an unseen force. Coincidentally, the Lutz children had taken upon sleeping to their stomachs. It was an eerie parallel to the tragic fate of the DeFeo victims, who were discovered lifeless on their own beds, on their stomachs. It was little Missy Lutz who, in her innocence, began hearing voices and seeing a strange pair of crimson eyes peering through her window as she slept. Initially startled, curiosity soon overcame the child, and she found herself engaging in conversations with the mysterious presence. "George, could you check on Missy? I can hear her giggling and talking to someone."
Baby, just let her giggle. She's not hurting anybody.
She should be asleep. I don't want her grouchy in the morning.
It's not a big deal, Kathy. It's not like she has school tomorrow or a job.
Well, it's easy for you to say. You don't have to deal with her attitude in the morning. And it's not just her. Daniel and Christopher are just as bad. It's this house.
The house is settling, and I'll agree, it's been a difficult adjustment to...
The noises and the cupboard slamming?
Whatever is in this house. But Kathy, it's our house now.
It's getting worse, George.
See? At least someone's pretending to have a good time. Fine, I'll go. I'll go check on her.
Thank you.
Sometimes it scares me, but now that I know it's you, it doesn't bother me so much. Do you always have to bang on the walls? It's scary. I don't like that.
Hey, little missy. What's going on in here?
Oh, hi, George.
Shouldn't you be sleeping?
I can't sleep.
Aw, and why's that?
There's a really bad smell keeping me up.
Bad smell? I don't smell anything.
Well, it's gone now.
Okay, let's tuck you back into bed. Hey, Missy, I heard you talking to someone.
Yeah, that was just Jody.
Who's Jody?
My friend. She's a pig.
Missy, that's not very nice.
No, George. Jody is a pig.
Oh, well, is she here now?
She was, but she left. She sits outside my window in the tree. Her eyes can be scary.
Her eyes?
Yeah, she has big red eyes.
A pig with red eyes who climbs trees? Jody definitely sounds like an interesting pig.
Well, she's a normal pig. She's more like a demon pig. She tells me to do things sometimes.
What kind of things?
I can't say. She'll get mad.
Missy, there is no demon in this house. There is nothing to be scared about.
Those people died in our house. Jody made it happen.
Look, Missy, there's nothing to be scared about. And Jody didn't do those things. Jody is just in your imagination.
No, she's not.
You can't let this house scare you. You're a big girl, right?
She's here at the window.
Jody isn't... Oh my God!
I told you.
Missy, go find your mom!
Under the veil of darkness, Missy found herself haunted by the demonic entity named Jody, who took form of a pig. Night after night, the pig's piercing gaze penetrated her bedroom window, filling her with a sense of dread. This unsettling connection to the DeFeo case became even more chilling when Butch DeFeo revealed that the demon who had possessed him had also taken form of a pig. Jody whispered to Missy, foretelling a grim fate, proclaiming that they were destined to be bound together within the walls of the infamous Amityville house, playing their twisted games for eternity. The next morning, on December 1st, 1976, multiple tracks of pig hoof prints were discovered in the fresh morning snow. As time passed, the malevolent presence within the house grew stronger, corrupting objects in its wake. One particular item, a delicate porcelain lion statue that adorned the living room, became the vessel for darkness. George, the patriarch of the family, recounted a harrowing incident where he stumbled upon the statue, only to find bite marks etched into his skin upon closer inspection. Fearing further harm, he relocated the statue to another room, but to his astonishment, it mysteriously returned to its original spot. During a moonlit evening, George's eyes fluttered open to the bewildering sight of Kathy, his wife, defying gravity as she floated across the bedroom. Determined, he mustered all of his strength and managed to grab onto her ethereal form as she gently glided back down to the floor. On January 14, 1976, the Lutz family experienced an unbearable escalation of demonic power in the house. After enduring 28 days of torment, they made the difficult decision to leave, leaving behind their dreams and embarking on the journey to reclaim their lives. Their silence has left many questions unanswered, leaving room for speculation and theories to circulate. The reasons behind their decision to withhold this information may be deeply personal and sensitive. As a result, the true nature of what transpired and what drove them from their home remains a mystery. But George Lutz did say this quote, "I will never be able to set aside what had gone on that night. And the boys, what they looked like and what they said when they came down that morning. We did not move in and move out as the same family. All of us were quite frightened by the time we left and knew of no fear when we moved in. And the fear alone was something that changed us all." After the Lutzes left their home, George reached out to Stephen Kaplan, a renowned parapsychologist known for his expertise in vampirology. George asked Stephen to investigate the house, and Stephen agreed. He clarified that their services were free, but any findings would be made public. And if nothing was found, and this is believed to be a hoax, then they would tell the public as well. 3 days had passed when George, visibly agitated, reached out to Stephen Kaplan and expressed his frustration. He made it clear that he strongly opposed any form of publicity associated with the ongoing investigations. George was particularly upset with Stephen for publicly declaring their intention to investigate the Amityville house. George postponed the investigation, claiming that he didn't want publicity. However, to Stephen Kaplan's surprise, the Lutz family had already given a press conference earlier that day, contradicting George's claim. Now, the press conference that the Lutz family was given was organized by William Weber. Who was that? Remind me, Ashley. Please remind me. It was the Amityville mass murderer, Butch Ronald DeFeo's lawyer, who at this moment in time was currently helping Butch DeFeo again with an appeal from prison. So in amidst this opportune time, George Lutz disclosed that William Weber had organized the press conference with Newsday and that the media insisted that the Lutz family be present. So following their departure from the Amityville house, the Lutz family had maintained connections with Weber, and publishers had been approaching the district attorney with book deals related to the Amityville case since Butch DeFeo and the murder trial, and it was his client. Weber mentioned that a freelance writer named Paul Hoffman, he was from the news, and he contacted him expressing that the Lutz family was interested in discussing a potential book deal. And attorney William Weber arranged a meeting with the Lutz family. Now Weber said, quote, "I had been given an oral commitment that we would get a large advance for a book and a movie," end quote. See, this is where everything starts to get a little bit like, oh, a price tag on this story? Sure, why not? I can add some shit to it. So in later interviews, Weber openly admitted to divulging significant details about the DeFeo murders to the Lutz family. And ironically, these very same details became essential elements to the horror stories that the Lutz family started to claim they encountered at the Amityville house. Now, throughout multiple meetings with the DeFeos at their new residence, Weber and the Lutz family, they drank many bottles of wine and concocted the paranormal story that would become the worldwide classic, The Amityville Horror. District Attorney William Weber admitted, quote, "We were there from about 9 or 10 in the evening to 3 in the morning, drinking wine, and I can't tell you how many bottles of wine we had, but it was many. I had photographs of the crime scene, and based upon those photographs and other facts that I had related, we developed what ultimately turned out to be part of the Lutz's version of the possession aspect of the case," end quote. Now, at a later time, the Lutz family allowed New York Channel 5 news reporter Laura DiDio to listen to the tape recordings that they had made the night with William Weber. And it completely showed their involvement in crafting their haunting story. And when George gave the tape to Laura, he said, quote, "I'm not particularly proud of this." In the Real Amityville Horror documentary, William Weber revealed a significant piece of evidence from the DeFeo crime that was this greenish fingerprint powder left by the forensics team, which was found on the walls and throughout of the house. And the Lutz family, in turn, they described it as resembling green slime oozing from the doors. So you see how it's manipulating key facts within their ghost story. Additionally, the crime scene photos depicted numerous dead flies in Dawn DeFeo's bedroom, because her body was left there for 48 hours upon discovery, just so they can have an investigation. Of course there's going to be flies. The Lutz family seized upon this detail to incorporate it into their own account, claiming to have been plagued by swarms of flies throughout their experience. They were armed with best-selling factual case information, and the Lutz family believed that their fabricated story would be more convincing. They anticipated a smooth journey ahead. However, attorney William Weber had different plans. He intended to allocate 5% of the proceeds from the book and the movie deals
to Butch DeFeo. And thank God the proposition was declined passionately by the Lutz family, and they broke off immediate contact with William Weber, because no one wants to pay killers for their own murders. So good move on the Lutz family. Eventually, they joined forces with Jay Anson, aligning their interests and forging together the Amityville Horror, the true story. Believing their story, the New York City Channel 5 news reporter Laura DiDio gathered a team of psychic researchers to investigate the claims, which included Ed and Lorraine Warren, renowned investigators of the supernatural. The Warrens have since sold the rights to their cases to Warner Brothers, who created the million-dollar Conjuring and Annabelle franchises. Ed and Lorraine Warren were confronted with bone-chilling evidence that corroborated the Lutz's harrowing experiences. However, as they delved deeper into the case, an unsettling feeling began to creep over them, as if they were facing a malevolent and demonic force. Lorraine noticed that those who were around her were being affected during her seances. A cameraman reported experiencing stabbing chest pains, while psychic Mary Dawn sensed the presence of a troubled teenager who committed a horrifying act against his own family. Every one of the psychics claimed to have seen a spirit in the house. Meanwhile, the reporters did not have the same experience. The crew strategically positioned automatic flash cameras that would trigger at specific intervals. In one photograph captured at the top of the stairs, a distinct glowing face of a young boy was eerily visible in the doorway. As experts delved deeper into the investigation, it was concluded that the face belonged to none other than paranormal investigator Paul Bartz. A comparative analysis with another photograph taken of Paul Bartz inside of the house revealed striking similarities, as both the face in the photo and Paul Bartz were wearing the same exact shirt. Furthermore, it's important to note that the haunting face in the photograph could potentially be attributed to Paul Bartz's 10-year-old nephew, who joined them during the investigation. Paul Bartz later commented on the mysterious ghost boy photograph taken the night of March 6, 1976, addressing the photo resemblance to him, saying, quote, "The image in the photo does resemble me, and I know that Ed, who is now deceased, and Lorraine went on record and national television stating that it was a ghost. And because I have great respect and admiration for them, I will say no more on the issue, and I will allow the legend of the most haunted house in America to continue." Research journalist Rick Moran compiled a list of over 100 factual errors between the factual story and the Amityville novel written by Jay Anson. Further investigation revealed that the Lutz's family claim about Jody the demonic pig leaving hoof prints in the snow on December 1, 1976 was false. Weather reports from that time frame confirmed that Amityville, New York had no recorded snowfall during that period. Reverend Ralph Beccario. This is the most interesting part to me. His credibility came into question as he contradicted himself multiple times. In 1979, he appeared on the popular TV show In Search Of, which delves into the controversial and paranormal topics. Well, on this show, Reverend Beccario affirmed the truth of everything he had experienced at the Amityville house. He recounted getting physically slapped by an unknown presence and being commanded to get out by a demonic voice. Now, during the Lutz versus Weber lawsuit, Reverend Ralph Beccario, under oath, provided a signed affidavit admitting that he had never set foot in the Amityville house or on the property before. When investigators probed into the relationship between Reverend Beccario and the Lutz family, it was revealed that the previous story was false. They never knew him. Contrary to George Lutz's claims of being a longtime friend of the father, Reverend Beccario signed that he had no prior connection to the family and that he had not assisted George with his annulment for his first marriage, as stated in the press and the Amityville novel. So during the interrogation, the Lutz family, they were asked to provide details about their initial first meeting with Reverend Beccario. Their testimony revealed that they only ever spoke to him over the phone in July of 1975. Kathy Lutz, she clarified that they had never met in person, and this information strongly indicated that Father Beccario did not have a significant prior relationship with the Lutz family before their arrival at the Amityville house. Additionally, it's noted that the Lutz family, they got married on July 4th, 1975, making it impossible for Father Beccario to have offered guidance to them before their marriage. So these inconsistencies further just raised doubts about the credibility of the Lutz's family claims. Now, Reverend Beccario, God bless his soul, he passed away on January 26, 1987, at the age of 52. And
It's all up for debate if he was a key player in the Amityville hoax or an unwitting bystander unknowingly entangled in this web of deception. Now, there's a theory that the Amityville house was constructed on an ancient Indian burial ground, but this has been refuted by members of the Shinnecock Indian Nation. They were the original owners of the land, and the claims in the Amityville book suggest that the Shinnecock tribe, they used to bury their mentally ill on the site, but this has been thoroughly debunked. Extensive research and investigations have shown no evidence to support these claims, leading to the dismissal of this particular theory surrounding the Amityville house. Now let's talk about Jody the pig. Allow me, Ashley Lana, to introduce you to Jody, the mischievous pig with an outworldly aura who unexpectedly materialized in Missy's bedroom throughout a window in the second story. As investigators presented their compelling photographs of Jody the pig to the Lutz's family's neighbors, everyone just started laughing. And investigators discovered that Robert Butch was always mentioning a demonic pig, and the Lutzes got a hold of this information. But when Butch wasn't tripping on acid, he explained that Jody was in fact the next door neighbor Rufus Ireland's wife's cat. Mrs. Ireland owned a Persian cat that was overweight, and Rufus recalled Butch DeFeo always calling the cat a pig. This cat was infamous for jumping on neighbors' windows and just staring in, causing its eyes to reflect. It is now 1977, precisely on September 13th, and author Jay Anson unveiled his groundbreaking book, The Amityville Horror, A True Story. Now, this book captivated this spine-chilling tale of the Lutz family and explained that it was all true. And they found themselves entangled in basically the clutches of this possessed home. That was basically the premise of the story, that they got chased out by demons that lived in their house and they were only able to stay in there for 28 days. Now, this book left readers captivated and just filled with a sense of both dread and fascination towards the devil and possession. Then in 1979, the Amityville Horror film adaptation came out, and it struck terror worldwide, and it earned Jay Anson millions of dollars, while the Lutz family only profited a mere $300,000. As the hype surrounding the Amityville grew, it prompted curious individuals to really examine into the claims made in the book, and they discovered that many of these assertions failed to align with any logical sense. The release of the Amityville books and the movie, it left paranormal investigators astounded, and they began to question how Jay Anson could boldly claim a true story on the cover of his book, only to fabricate 90% of the story. And this revelation really opened eyes for potential manipulation and sensationalism that occur in the realm of paranormal accounts. And this is rich. So the screenwriter for the Amityville horror film adaptation, Sandor Stern, he asked Jay Anson if he believed what was written in his book was true. And Jay Anson responded, quote, "I am a writer. That's what I do. I write. That's all. Whether or not it's true or whether it's not true is up to the reader to decide." Now, even Lorraine Warren admitted that she is fully aware that the book and the movie have creative license, and she admits that she does not support that aspect of adaptions, says the woman who sold her life's rights to Warner Brothers. So, if that says anything. Journalist Rick Moran, he called out Jay Anson as well, saying that he wrote lies, and what Jay Anson told him was, quote, "My only interest is to write a best-selling book so I can build a house and never have to write again." And let's add to this. When parapsychologist Peter Jordan confronted Jay Anson and questioned him about the authenticity of the story, Anson's response was as follows. "You're one of those naysayers. You're a skeptic who likes to write non-ghost stories. I like to make money. And one day I predict that you're going to be sitting broke while writing your little non-ghost stories. And I'm going to be on an island out in the Bahamas or somewhere with a truckload of cashmere sweaters." "George, cashmere, is this cashmere?" "Of course it's cashmere. What's this red dot?" Oh, if you know, you know. When the 2005 remake of the Amityville Horror was released with Buff Daddy Deadpool, Ryan Reynolds, he was manhandling that axe as George Lutz, good stuff. Well, the real George Lutz had an absolute hissy fit, calling the original a documentary in comparison. This is just my thing. I think it's probably because George was depicted as such a villain in the remake, and
if we've learned anything from George Lutz, he doesn't like it when people make up stories about him unless he's involved with that creative aspect. The irony. George Lutz tried suing MGM Studios because he hated it that much. And George Lutz likes to try and sue everyone who touches his factual story. And when his wife Kathy passed away on August 17, 2004, at the age of 57, it made that legal battle a lot more difficult for him because he was doing it on his own. Now, it's said that the haunting experience of the Amityville had taken such a toll on Kathy's body that she appeared to be in her 80s, prematurely aged just by the horrors that she endured. Now, on May 8, 2006, George Lutz, the former owner of the Amityville house, he passed away due to heart disease. And although George and Kathy had gotten divorced in the 1980s, they maintained a very good, healthy professional partnership as business partners and writers, even after their separation. In 2012, Daniel Lutz, their son, he spoke out after 35 years recounting his experiences in the Amityville house in his documentary titled My Amityville Horror, where he continues to allege the possessions were real. And in this documentary, it's interesting, Daniel refuses to take a polygraph test to prove that he's telling the truth because he gets very offended, visually offended, that people don't believe what he's saying. He's very, I was the one in the house, you shouldn't question me, even though many people have come forth being involved saying it was a load of crap, except for the Lutz family. And Lutz, no one wants to be called a liar, so okay, I get it. That's cool. The neighbors of the Lutz family, they expressed their skepticism towards the alleged haunting story, as they never engaged in conversation with the Lutz family about any paranormal experiences, nor did they hear any of the screams. Rufus Ireland, the next door neighbor, he firmly believed that the Lutz family had meticulously planned the entire story as a means to profit from their purchase of the infamous murder house. The subsequent owners of the house, Jim and Barbara Cromati, following the Lutz family, they openly stated that they never encountered any paranormal experiences, and they emphasized that the doors and the cabinets in the house had the original designs in paint, which directly contradicted the Lutz family's claims of these objects mysteriously flying off their hinges on multiple occasions and tearing the house apart. Let's continue. In 2010, Carolyn and David D'Antonio made the bold move of purchasing the infamous horror house. Determined to change its dark reputation, they embarked on a complete redesign of the entire property. The most notable transformation was the removal of the eerie evil eyes that once adorned the two attic windows, erasing the house's scary appeal. Additionally, the structure received a fresh coat of paint, breathing a new life into its exterior. To further distance themselves from the house's haunting past, the D'Antonios decided to change the address from 112 to 108 Ocean Avenue. This small but significant alteration aimed to sever the ties to the notorious events that had taken place within its walls. Unfortunately, tragedy struck in 2016 when David D'Antonio passed away. The house was subsequently sold in February of the following year, and the new owners, whose identities remain unknown, took possession of the property. Then, on January 24, 2023, the house changed hands once again, this time fetching a staggering $1.46 million. The buyers' identities remain unknown. But since the renovations carried out in 2017, the attention surrounding the location of the Amityville house has significantly diminished. The house now stands as a testament to the power of transformation and the ability to move beyond a dark past. Butch DeFeo, in his final testament, spoke of the house that he had elevated to legendary status, saying, quote, "I guess the Amityville horror is really supposed to be me, because I'm the one that got convicted of killing my family. I'm the one who said I did it. I'm the one supposed to be possessed by the devil." The actual real story of the DeFeo murders and the Amityville horror. If you would like to believe that a residual haunting was present in the Amityville house, or even a demonic entity, then it leaves you with a great bedtime story. Based on the crime investigations, the extensive witness statements, and the fact-checking conducted, it's not uncommon for individuals to form the belief that the Amityville story was a fabricated hoax orchestrated by the Lutz family. And it is crucial to approach each conclusion with a critical mindset, considering all the available evidence and acknowledging the ongoing debates and
differing viewpoints among researchers, the skeptics and the believers, the truth behind the events of the Amityville House remains subject of speculation and interpretation. And a heartfelt, huge thank you goes out to our esteemed Fear Cult members, Jeff and his extraordinary daughter, Abby, for their exceptional participation in this week's captivating dramatization. Your talent and dedication, it brought the story to life in a truly remarkable way, and I am immensely grateful for your voices as George Lutz and Missy. Thank you. Jeff and Abby also performed in the John Wayne Gacy episode of Lullaby, so their versatile talent continues to astound us all, and I am honored to have you as part of our Fear Cult. Your dedication and passion are deeply appreciated.
There'll be more, many more. They're coming for me now. And then they'll come for you.
Back on our never-ending quest to find a truly scary movie, I am recommending the 2000 supernatural horror thriller, What Lies Beneath, starring Harrison Ford and Michelle Pfeiffer. This is not a gore fest or a slasher. It really stirs up the psychological aspect of fear, and it shows how gaslighting can mess a person up when it comes to hauntings. Married couple Norm and Claire seem to have the perfect marriage. Of course they do, until Claire begins hearing mysterious voices and sees a young woman in their house. So I tried to scare you, now you try to scare me. Follow Lullaby on Instagram at Lullaby the Fear Podcast, where you can get constant updates on episodes. So thank you for listening to this week's lullaby. Sweet dreams. Lights out.